Well, thanks very much to the organizers for the chance to speak and participate in this conference, which I've really enjoyed. So what I'm going to talk about is in the context of trying to realize something like a string compactification, which describes something like our universe, or describes our universe, what we'd like to do is have some ingredients to kind of make some of these sectors of the observed world, such as the standard model of particle physics, and perhaps something that describes something like inflation. Now, one of the things that's complicated about doing this is that there are a lot of moving parts that are going on at the same time in a typical compactification. So, for example, somebody might try and build, say, a standard model sector, and somebody else might try and build, say, some other part of the sector. And then when they try to talk and bring these things together, it may be that, well, the conditions that they want on one part are completely incompatible. And part of the problem is that a lot of the geometric parameters that go into these models have to be stabilized in some way. And it may be that when we try and talk about the stabilization of those things, it may be incompatible with where we wanted to sit for, say, something like a standard model. So in this case, I should probably be apologizing even more than Alex, because I'm not going to talk about even gravity in this context. So what I'm going to do is kind of focus on the particle physics side of the story and ask what happens in this context when I try to really work at the level of a field theory limit and try and describe something relevant like the standard model in that context. So first I'll try to provide some motivation for why you might be interested in taking a particular limit. Then I'll discuss some of the ingredients that go into such construction. And then we'll see that in the context of taking this limit for these higher dimensional theories, trying to get something that where gravity decouples from the description requires the internal directions to start looking non-commutative or fuzzy. So I'll explain how to describe, how to talk about those types of fuzzy geometry, and how to write down something like how to write down a 4D effective theory when you wrap brains on such fuzzy geometry. And what are the consequences of wrapping on such a fuzzy geometry? Then we'll talk about a limit where we can kind of see kind of the ingredients, the seven brains, things that are, have one temporal direction and seven spatial directions, how those things can kind of be assembled out of kind of fuzzy components coming from these kind of things. Okay, so the motivation is that, well, it seems that there is a whole landscape of string vacua, and presumably some of them contain things of interest for observation, but it's not completely clear just from this which ones have the correct microscopic ingredients to describe our world. So some of the complications are that trying to include, say, gravity and particles at the same time appears to be quite complicated. As we already mentioned, some of the particle information that you want to use to construct these kind of models depends on details of kind of the internal directions of the compactification. But on the other hand, a lot of these features of the geometry, if we conclude that gravity, are going to be dynamical. So it seems that we have to treat both things at the same time. Also, kind of an obvious fact that we live in four dimensions, but if we're talking about kind of these higher dimensional field theories, which are quite common in this context, we typically have an infinite number of four-dimensional modes from the perspective of the 4D theory. And it means that it looks like there's that we go to high enough energy scale, there's a breakdown in when we're describing our 4D effective theory. So to summarize, it looks like it's complicated. So what I'm going to try and do is take a simplifying limit where I can kind of at least treat a part of this question with more control. So there's a simplifying limit I might be tempted to take, which is that if I look at, say, some of the energy scales of relevance for, say, particle physics, a lot of them are, or all of them are below the Planck scale. So, for example, the Lee scale is way below the Planck scale, and the Gut scale is also below the Planck scale by three orders of magnitude. So the strategy I'm going to adopt here is to, number one, try and look for theories in the context of string theory, which decouple from where gravity decouples from the story. What I'm going to do is also look for vacua where I have something that looks like a 4D effective field theory and try and get some of the ingredients of the standard model in that context. And then the hope is that I'll be able to take that, and then if somebody else is interested in using, say, the other pieces of the geometry or something else, I'm going to try and glue this back in for the rest of the story. I'm really only going to focus on the first two points and defer kind of how you would actually do this glue. Okay, so the geometric picture is that we imagine that, say, the standard model is localized somewhere like here. And the idea is that we have some complicated internal directions for this six-dimensional internal space. But we're going to be interested in kind of zooming in on the region of interest for, say, standard model in this kind of sector here. Okay. So it sounds like we can do anything we want if we decouple gravity from the story. Indeed, one of the ideas behind string theory is that we're providing some kind of UV completion, which includes both the particle physics and gravity sector. So we might think that we kind of lose all all constraints. Actually, demanding its absence is also a constraint in itself on the types of compactifications one wants to consider in this one. But it still turns out to be rather flexible. What turns out to be less flexible is when you try and combine this with actually the idea of having some kind of grand unified theory as well. And that's kind of one of the ingredients I'm going to put in. You get a little bit more predictivity out of these kinds of models. Okay, so what are the main assumptions I'm going to make? Number one is that I can find some kind of 4D theory decoupled that has a decoupling limit from gravity. And number two, that there is some notion of unification in the story. So by this I mean that if I look at something like the supersymmetric minimal extension of the supersymmetry of the standard model, I can look at the gauge coupling constants, and they appear to meet at some higher energy scale, which is distinct from the Planck scale. And then there's some perturbative gauge coupling at that higher energy scale. So I'm going to demand, again, just something where I can decouple gravity, and also something where I have some gut-like structure. Okay, so what are the ingredients that go into making something like the standard one? Okay, so if I'm interested in kind of deferring issues related to gravity, there's one way I can do it at a conceptual level, which is to separate out what I mean by, say, the open string degrees of freedom and the closed string degrees of freedom. And these can give rise to different types of excitations in the low energy theory. The open strings, the closed strings, sorry, can give rise to things like excitations such as gravity. But on the other hand, open strings can be used to build up the rest of the particle physics sector. And these are open strings, so they have a beginning and an end, and they end, they have Dirichlet boundary conditions on their end. And so they have to end somewhere. And the things that they end on are called Dirichlet. And these things are dynamical in their own right. Okay. So again, the idea is to basically focus on these open strings. Okay. So we're going to try and build things with open strings and see how far we can get. Okay. So some of the qualitative features come out right away from this kind of construction. So for example, if I wanted to realize something like QCD or SU3 gauge theory, I can take three of these D-brains, put them on top of each other, and then the gluons of the theory would correspond to open strings, which stretch from that same stack back to itself. So it fills out some 3x3 transfer matrix, and these things are supposed to correspond to the guys transforming in the adjoint representation of SU3. You can do a similar thing to, say, SU2. Now, what about matter in this kind of model? Things like quarks, guys that are charged under both, say, SU3 and SU2, can also be built in a similar way. This would correspond to something like a 3x2 transfer matrix. The quark could end on any of the three D-brains for the SU3 stack. It can end on two of them for the SU2 stack. And this will give us, say, something that is charged as under both QCD and also under SU2. Okay, so those are some of the nice qualitative ingredients that come out right away from these kind of open string constructions. Yeah?
Well, that would be something that attaches to SU2, and then also attaches to, say, the hyperdrive. If it's charged on there, that's going to be filling out a left arm double. Okay, but even though you can write down these kind of qualitative ingredients, what we'd like to know is also, can this be combined with one of the assumptions we wanted to make, namely the idea of having some kind of unified theory of the story? And here's where building things with open strings alone becomes a little bit more challenging. So if you work in a limit where we have a reliable perturbative expansion of the open string interactions,
there becomes a problem with realizing some features of gut. So if we work in the strict G-string extremely small limit. And the reason is that there are two couplings that we'd be interested in for generating, say, masses for the quark. One is, say, 5-10-10 coupling, which is known to rise for the top quark. And another one is the 5-bar-5-bar-10 for the bottom quark. So the idea here is that we imagine putting the Higgs field inside of, say, the fundamental of SU5 and the antifundamental, the 5-bar. And then the matter field will organize into other representations. So, for example, one antifundamental index or two, antisymmetric indices. So, for some of the matter. And you can show that basically the 5-10-10 is responsible for the top quark and 5-bar-5-bar-10 for the bottom. Now, at the level of string perturbation theory, what you can show is that the types of interaction terms you can write down are ones where the number of fundamental indices are equal to the number of anti-fundamental indices, because basically the strings have to link up with one another to form something close. That'll work for the 5-bar-5-bar-10. We have two boxes here and two anti-boxes here and two boxes here, but it won't work for the 5-10-10. So we would make a kind of dangerous prediction, which has been falsified, which is that the bottom would be heavier than the top mass in this kind of model. And that's definitely not true. So it sounds like we need to kind of relax a little bit some of the restrictions we're putting in on the way we're building these models. So it looks like what I need to do is include something more non-perturbative to account for, say, a large top load mass. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at a limit where I increase the value of G string to be something that's order one. If I just work with these perturbative strings, I can organize everything according to these kind of things with one beginning and end. We can show that actually there are other types of things that have kind of one spatial extent. We have V1 brains, things like this, and these V1 brains and fundamental strings can start to form complicated bound states. And using these bound states, we can show that indeed more ingredients start to enter the theory. And now you can actually show that something like the top quark can get a mass in these kind of models. Okay, so this sounds rather dangerous, though, because one of the reasons I would want to work at small g string is precisely because I have kind of a perturbative expansion to use for the model. Now it sounds like I'm kind of doing away with that. Now I've decided to go precisely to a limit where order one. Okay, so one way to describe these kind of models, at least some of the data of these kind of non-perturbative vacuum, is in terms of what's known as F theory. And this is kind of taking the 10 dimensions of usual string theory and adding to it some extra geometric structure to describe kind of a more general strongly coupled theory. But we view the coupling constant as now an additional geometric parameter in this kind of model. So the idea is that we add on, in addition to our 10 space time dimensions, some torus and two torus. And the shape of that two torus, the parallel sides identified for this parallelogram, is dictated by the value of tau, which is the complexified string coupling constant. Now, something interesting can happen in these kind of geometries, which is that the value of tau, as we move around, can now slide around and not be constant. However, what can also happen is that this two torus itself can start to pinch off, like here and here. When that happens, the theory is actually telling us something about an extra ingredient that's in the story, namely a 7 brain. These are guys that have one temporal direction and 7 spatial directions. And these are the main players for building these standard models, or building these gut models in the context of F. So what is the way that these 7 brains come in to build something like the standard? So just to orient ourselves in the geometry, the idea is that we have some gut brain. This will have something like SE5 gauge theory or SO10 gauge theory, something like that. It fills our Minkowski directions and then some extra dimension. So 4 of the 6 internal directions. Then we can have extra guys coming in and intersecting them. And they'll intersect typically over Riemann surfaces or points of the geometry. So for example, getting something like the gauge theory corresponds to a 7 brain which fills 0 through 3 and then 4 through 7. And then 6D matter is something where we have pairwise intersections of the 7 brain. And that'll happen along, say, the 4-5 direction or, say, 7 gut intersecting 7 prime, and so on. So you can get matter from these kind of intersections, and then Yukawa coupling interactions between those guys for something like the top quark or the bottom quark masses coming from these kind of intersections. Okay, so these are the kind of qualitative ingredients going into building. Okay, so indeed one can show, I'm not going to go into much detail here, but the idea is that you basically have, again, the 6-dimensional manifold. You have your gut brain, you have some other brains coming in, intersecting it, and then various intersections give you various ingredients in the low energy theory. Now, one of the interesting things is that actually, again, this 5-10-10 coupling required us to work at kind of an order one value for the string coupling. That'll be important later when I come back to kind of fuzzy limits on the value of the gut coupling itself. So one of the nice things, however, about this kind of geometric picture is a lot of the ingredients we're using can be described in terms of holomorphic equations. And this is the kind of thing that's usually protected by some notion of supersymmetry. So it's the kind of thing we can trust, even though we're talking about something, you know, wildly non-perturbative because G string is of order one. Okay, so now those are the basic qualitative ingredients that we're going to put into the model. The next thing we'd like to do is ask what happens when we go back to one of the other assumptions we're going to put, namely trying to decouple gravity from the configuration. And what we're going to see is that it starts to look fuzzy for various reasons. Okay, so let's go back to our 7-brain gauge theory. This was an 8-dimensional gauge theory. It was something that involved effectively an infinite number of 4-dimensional fields. We can take one of our 8-dimensional fields. It'll have position dependence on our space-time direction, as well as some internal space-time, internal coordinates. And we can expand the whole thing in terms of some set of harmonics. And when we do this, we can write down, say, a wave equation that this phi is supposed to satisfy. And we'll get something like this. Namely, each of these AIs can be an eigenvalue, we correspond to a harmonic form with respect to a particular internal Laplacian. We can decompose the whole thing so that the phi sub I look like an infinite collection of 4D fields of various masses dictated by that internal Laplacian. So these modes start to enter the story and start to complicate things when we get up to sufficiently high energy scales from the perspective of the 4D theory. It'll be set basically by the radius of curvature of the compactification. So the limit it sounds like we want to take is one where we decouple those modes or this infinite set of modes from the story. So it sounds like we want to work at limits where the energy is less than that radius of curvature. So to fully decouple them, what I should really do is I should either integrate them all out or I should send this R4 to zero size. Okay, now that's a natural place for things to get stuck. It's not the only place things can get stuck, but there is kind of old argument suggesting why this is kind of natural. The idea is, let's imagine writing down an effective potential for this, this modulus, and let's ask what is the behavior of this mode if we just write down kind of generic behaviors for the effective potential. So in the most generic case, we might imagine it kind of slopes out like this, slopes in like this, or just flat. In this case, we say it runs away, and it basically becomes very large and infinite. That's not the one we're interested in. There's another limit where this thing kind of slides down to smaller values. It'll get stabilized at, say, some stringy values or maybe even zero volume from the perspective of the low energy observer. So this is a natural limit, at least, to think about things getting stuck. And in this older work, they also applied this, you can apply this to other things and say things like, well, we expect the string coupling to also be, we expect the strong coupling for almost everything. Okay, so now what kind of four manifold, we wanted to wrap the seven grain on a four manifold of some type, what kind of objects like this can be decoupled in this way? Well, we're demanding that we can kind of shrink this four manifold down to a point. And that's a non-trivial restriction on the internal geometry. It basically requires that this thing, if we write down a metric for this thing, it has to have positive curvature. I have to be able to shrink this thing to a point without destroying the topology of the space. So what's an example of this in lower dimensions? If I look in, say, two real dimensions, and classify all of these compact Riemann surfaces according to their genus. And here we have basically one positive curvature manifold, the sphere. Everything else, when I try to shrink it to a point, I'll be destroying some topological cycle. So out of this infinite list of possible two manifolds I could have imagined, only one of them has this limit where I can shrink it to a point. And something similar happens for these four manifolds, assuming it has some kind of it corresponds to a Taylor surface. They're only tensorial.
I think so. I mean, it's kind of a really just crude thing from algebraic geometry. It's just demanding a point contraction. And you don't even have to get into the explicit form of the metric to really. But yeah, okay, so that's already an interesting restriction. We demanded that we kind of decouple gravity in an infinite list of four manifolds which are written down. And now we have a more tractable list.
But there's a problem with the limit I'm trying to take, which is that if I look at the seven-brain gauge theory, I can write it down. Let's just write down the classical action. We have some A.T. Lagrangian like this. And then I can try and write down the 4D effective theory by averaging over the internal coordinate to get something that looks four-dimensional. So when I do that, well, these modes will have some expansion. There'll be some volume factor that comes out front. And that volume factor, divided by appropriate length scales here, is what sets the value of the Yang-Mills coupling in the low-energy theory. Also, if I equate the coefficients here and here, well, what I learn is that the Yang-Mills coupling constant is actually going as the inverse of the volume. This sounds very bad from the perspective of trying to get something realistic. I've taken a limit now where the coupling is blowing up, whereas I wanted to take a limit where it was perturbative. I mean, look around you, things are quite perturbative. It doesn't blow up. So what have I done wrong? Well, nothing so far. There's a subtlety, however, from the perspective of the string compactification, which I'm going to exploit to allow me to take the zero volume limit, but at the same time retain a gauge coupling. And it exploits the fact that the open strings and the closed strings can sometimes see different geometries. So this is really a statement about the closed string. closed string geometry going or blowing up. The open string piece I'm going to try and keep fine. So how does that work? The idea is that if we write down this 8B gauge theory, what we've done, we can also switch on internal magnetic fluxes. And the open strings correspond to kind of dipoles that are getting spread out by the presence of this magnetic flux. What we're doing is we switch on this flux by a lot, we can switch on this flux by some amount, and it will prevent the open strings from kind of collapsing on top of each other. They'll remain spread out. This will happen even if I try and take a limit where this thing drops to zero size. So the limit I'm talking about is really one in which I allow this, the volume as measured by the closed string degree of freedom, or maybe the closed string measure, letting that drop to zero size. But we can write down still an effective gauge theory in 4D, and it will be given by basically taking that amount of flux and integrating it over the formula.
For that B, the curly B there.
You mean, I'm going to do some like amount of tension in the brain by doing this.
Yeah, square root of the volume squared plus B squared.
So it
actually has a potential that drives it. So you have to play something off against that in order to stabilize it at the value that you want. It's not
right. Well, no, but my natural expectation, okay, so there's two pieces to this kind of script. There's the flux piece, which I would say is kind of quantized, and then there's this B field piece, which
is so the whole thing is variable, is continuously variable, and there's a potential for it.
I think what Inway is saying is that you have to deal with closed string moduli at the same time.
Yeah, but this, I'm saying the brain that you're talking about gives a potential for the closed string modulus that you're talking about. So,
well, my expectation would still be actually that I expect kind of the closed string volume to get stuck at the zero side, and there'll be some quantized piece left over.
There's the volume, but then there's also this axion, and I'm just saying that the axion has a potential because of the brain that you've wrapped on the site. So you've introduced a potential for this thing.
Yeah, but I expect the axion potential to actually have a minimum that kind of B equal to zero or something like that.
Well, but it'll have a minimum at F plus B equals zero, right? Because it's the Debye action has a square root of the volume which you said is zero.
No, plus, I mean, why does there have to be one minimum for this thing? Why does it have to be one?
Well, I'm just saying you need other contributions. The brain itself.
Oh, yeah.
This is the potential that drives this effect
away.
Is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, you're saying the gauge coupling still wants to drop to zero size. I mean, sorry, the gauge coupling wants to drop to infinite size.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm saying that there's something going on in this small volume limit, but there could be other instantons coming in and could be producing a more complicated.
That's fine. You can make that assumption, but.
So I'm assuming that there's some flexibility with these other instantons coming. Yeah, I agree.
Well, just another question. I mean, in the real world, this decoupling is not very, it's not infinitely strict. So throwing out most of the geometries on the basis of saying they have to contract literally to a point is an argument I don't quite understand.
Well, typically, though, I mean, when you're trying to kind of get the gut scale to come out correctly, it's not that easy. I mean, you kind of
that could be. I'm just saying that it's not. We don't literally need to contract something to a point to get the real world. It's a few orders of magnitude.
But then I would ask how much control do I really have over my field theory? I mean, it's not a 4D field theory. There's no limit I can take to make it a 4D. So at some point, I have to face that it's a high dimensional field theory.
Gravity exists, but it may be.
Yeah, I agree. But I was trying to defer those complications. So the idea is kind of. I don't want to kind of. Hamper too much with what happens in the gut. I agree. I mean, if one is suitably strong, one can do the whole thing at once, and then, I agree. Okay, so what happens to the gauge coupling constant now that we've taken this funny-looking limit? Well, now it's being set by the amount of flux that we've been able to cover, and it's given by some
integer and set by a unit of inverse G string. Okay, so what's happening now to the open string? The point is that now we've kind of introduced a limit where the open and closed strings are seeing different-looking geometries. The closed string volume, we're saying we want it to be driven to zero size. That's the one that we can contemplate. But at the same time, what we're saying is that the open strings don't see that same geometry. They're remaining at the finite size. So now what's happening is that these strings are being spread out, and it sounds like they're getting attached to some fuzzy point. I'll make that more precise shortly. fuzzy point specified basically by the amount of flux we've switched on. So what can I say more precisely? Well, it's known in the context of flat space, when you try and take a similar zero slope limit for string acceleration, that switching on a B-field, script B-field like this, causes the internal causes those directions to become non-commutative. And it's very analogous to what would happen if you, say, tried to study quantum mechanics with a magnetic field switched on. The phase space coordinates you talk about, say, the momenta, would no longer commute once I switch on this magnetic field. What we're doing in this limit is we're essentially keeping just the lowest Landau level of that description. So from that perspective, what we're doing is we're seeing that the open string C now are non-commutative or fuzzy geometry. Now, the problem, however, is that this has really been worked out in most detail for the cases of string propagation in flat space. What we want to do is we want to apply this now to more general geometry. After all, we wanted to have, say, a compact setting. So I need to somehow extend this non-commutative description into more general compact four-dimensional space. How do I do that? Okay, so the usual way to approach non-commutative geometry is to start from the classical geometry. Usually we specify it by saying it's a collection of points of some kind. And then we say, well, when we want to pass to the non-commutative theory, I shouldn't talk about points anymore. What I should talk about really is the algebra of functions defined over that classical space. And then what I do is I imagine deforming it to some quantum version. So I imagine that my f and g, they become some f hat and g hat, and then there's some deformation, corresponding to some deformation of the algebra, and then I just work in some very abstract terms. That's a little too abstract for actually writing down the effective theory of a 47 brain. So what I'm going to do is take a complementary viewpoint, which is to view this f hat as an operator acting on a Hilbert space, which I'll call a script H for now. And then there's some states in that Hilbert space, and these states are acted on by these f hats, and these are the fuzzy points. So H is kind of the vector space of these fuzzy points. So there's still a notion of the strings attaching to these kind of points of this now fuzzy geometry. Okay, so what do these fuzzy Hilbert spaces look like? Well, there's a very nice way to write down classical geometry, which has a lot of symmetries to it, which I'm going to exploit to write down kind of a canonical prescription for the fuzzy geometry, which is based on the so-called gauge linear sigma. So the idea here is that we have some two-dimensional gauge theory, and then the classical vacua of that gauge theory give us a description for talking about geometries in more general terms. So the idea is that we have some complex fields, Z1 through ZR, and they parameterize coordinates on, say, CR. And then we have so-called what are called D-term constraints. So we imagine some potential such that its minima satisfy this constraint. And then we mod out by the remaining gauge rotation of that system. When we do this, you wind up with a complex manifold. And the complex manifold has complex dimension R minus the number of constraints one imposes here. So if those are S, we have a complex R minus S dimensional manifold. The reason why it's S complex constraints is that this is one real constraint, and this is another real constraint. Okay, the point is that type of construction generalizes right away to the fuzzy story. We can start from the quantized versions of the coordinates, like this. They have some commutation relation, specified by an ambient background flux. And what we do is we construct the corresponding Fock space of fuzzy points. Okay, just by acting on some vacuum operator like that. The subspace constraint that we had before translates directly to a Hamiltonian constraint on the type of Hilbert space we're interested in. So we get out some constraint like this on the space of fuzzy points. And that defines for us a fuzzy subspace cut out by these so-called B-term constraints. Okay. So what's an example of how this works? For example, we can take fuzzy S2. The idea is that we imagine two coordinates, C1 and Z2. So we're imagining that the two-sphere kind of lives inside of a quotient of C2 imposed by this B-term constraint. So we have Z1 and Z2, and they satisfy some commutation. And we can write down the Schwinger presentation for these for this SE2 algebra. We view the Z's as a doublet, and they get acted on. We can form a matrix, usual Pauli matrices, and then we can form a usual SE2 algebra. Fuzzy points then get moved around by the action of this angular momentum algebra. This is kind of the fuzzy south pole, and this is the fuzzy north pole. Now we can go back to the thing we're interested in, when we're describing seven brain gap in more complicated things. I'll only do it for the case of a two-sphere times a two-sphere. The other cases are kind of similar. Yeah.
How do you tell the difference between an S2 and some other position?
Yeah, so the thing that's is this D-term constraint. Okay. so remember, when I talk about the usual Gaussian and signal model, I specify a set of U1 charges and their actions on the fields. Those D-term constraints tell me what kind of subspace I'm talking about. So those constraints here have a direct translation into the fuzzy language. That's what's providing me this kind of...
Well, it's providing, in some sense, the ground stage of your theory, in a sense, right?
Yeah, the lowest Landau level. Yeah, so sorry. Yeah.
So I have a completely related question, which is, in the GLSM, there are other fields, the gauge fields, and their superpartners, such as scalar and so on. And that's important for understanding singularity. So I'm very curious whether your generalization has those fields, and if so, how the singularities are affected by them.
You mean, for example, they have like a conical singularity, or...?
Well, here you're yeah, same.
Yeah, so you can study in this language kind of what happens to kind of the usual flop transition and that kind of thing.
Well,
and
I mean, so you have the whole theory, you have the whole Lagrangian of the GLSM, not just the equations from the Maxwell.
Right.
You do? Okay.
But no. I don't have the analog in the fuzzy case. This is more just a motivated ansatz based on kind of the symplectic symmetries. So you can build up basically almost all the differential geometry you have. In the usual classical fields. But clearly some things are missing, for example, like RG equals and things like that. That's not as transparent in this kind of way of talking about it. Okay.
So now let's say we wrap a seven brain on this fuzzy space. What do we wind up getting? So now we have, say, our two fuzzy S2 fills out some grid like this. And then inside of it we have some intersection of that seven brain, our gut seven brain, with some other seven brain. And that's supposed to be the matter for it. Now, in the usual classical geometry that we had, it said that this thing corresponds to the vanishing locus of some polynomial, holomorphic polynomial, in, say, the coordinates of one of the two spheres and the coordinates of the other two spheres. That's replaced now by an operator constraint in the fuzzy Hilbert space. And we take this thing, promote it to an operator, and then have it annihilate some set of states. And that's the locus corresponding to where this intersection takes place. The point is that all of this stuff is happening at the level of all of the holomorphic structures being preserved by doing this, because the Z's don't have a non-trivial, they have trivial commutators. The Z's and the daggers have non-trivial commutators. So what we're doing is we're preserving a lot of the holomorphic structure of the original compactification. And in particular, what we're doing is we're preserving some of that holomorphic structure, which was important when we were trying to provide an F-theory type description. Okay, so what does the 4D effective theory now look like? I'm not going to get too explicit with it, but you can write down the explicit form of this 8D Lagrangian. It's now given by taking this phi. It had some functional dependency before. Now it's become an operator acting on the 4D space, on this fuzzy Hilbert space. So now becomes a theory with a finite number of 4D fields. And they fill out basically n by n matrices set by the number of fuzzy points. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but for now it's just basically square matrix. The 8D Lagrangian now becomes an operator of that of this theory. And the 4D theory is given by integrating over the fuzzy points in the internal dimension. So we imagine tracing over those fuzzy points. And that's the 4D Lagrangian. And this can be treated as now a purely 4D theory, which is retaining some of the structure that we had of the original geometry. Okay, so what happens to the gauge coupling when we do this? We can write down the inverse gauge coupling constant squared like this, 4 pi over g squared. That'll be roughly the value of the gut coupling. And then we get out some tracing over the entire Hilbert space. What we're predicting now is that the value of the gauge coupling in the four dimension is set as the number of fuzzy points divided by this string coupling. There's another piece of input I have, however, which is, remember, I was interested in these models where I try and get a large top coordinate. And that required me to put the value of g string some specific value. So it's around a third root of unity. So what we're predicting, actually, is that now the value of the gut coupling constant, the inverse value of this, is going to be set by the number of fuzzy points. So again, this is coming because of two facts. One was depending this decoupling limit, which required us to go to this fuzzy thing, this fuzzy limit. And the other thing was that we were demanding that string coupling be such that we could realize this perturbative this top course Yukawa. Okay, and out comes this. So how many fuzzy points do we typically have in these kinds of geometries? Well, we can plug in this value for 25, and we'll get something like 25 fuzzy points. We imagined including some thresholds or something like that, which would drop this value down to, say, like 20, 15, or 10. The number of fuzzy points decreases, and the effects of the fuzzy geometry become more prominent. Okay. So now I'm going to take a closer look at the resulting seven brain theory and ask what does this kind of fuzzy seven brain look like from this fuzzy perspective. So I can write down the fuzzy SUN seven brain. Let's imagine we have some seven brain and it has SUN gauge school. We can view it as basically being this fuzzy seven brain is being built out of the D3 brain. And we can detect them through the presence of a basically topological term like this in the eight-dimensional theory. The idea is that there's some four-form potential. It couples to brains that have three spatial directions and one temporal direction. And the idea is that these things can give us some induced number of D3 brains filling our state. How many do I have? Well, we've already computed the value of this B squared to be the number of fuzzy points. That's the number of D3 brains. The D3 brains sit at each of the fuzzy points. And we have exactly 10 of them in each fuzzy point. Okay, so let's suggest the following picture. We might imagine trying to build up the seven brain itself from this kind of picture. We could start with a small number of these fuzzy points and keep throwing them in until we get something that looks like more our seven brain. And describing the ensemble of all possible ways of doing this, assembling this, sounds interesting. Okay, now there's one natural limit to think about, which is let's imagine expanding the number of fuzzy points in this context. We take the number of these fuzzy points and we let it become extremely large. It's known in a similar context that if I put a bunch of D3 brains on top of themselves, then it realizes a gravity dual, the form ADS5 times F5. And the basic relation is that the radius of curvature of this gravity dual is being set by the value of Tohoku coupling, the relation like this. And when Yang-Mills coupling constant squared, we organize the perturbation theory according to G Yang-Mills squared times N. And then we get a weakly curved dual when we let this Tohoku coupling become very large. So does something similar happen in the present context? Actually, something similar does not happen here, because if we try to compute the value of G squared Yang-Mills times NC times the number of fuzzy points and make N fuzz very large, we don't get something that's parametrically large. Rather, it becomes of order G string times NC. G string is of order 1, and C cannot be increased arbitrarily in these kind of models. So we don't get a weakly coupled dual. Rather, we get something more strongly coupled. And the reason is kind of clear. We didn't put the D3 brains on top of each other. What we did instead was stick them at kind of fuzzy points. They weren't coincident. We could, however, imagine going to higher energies and making them more dynamic. And here we might imagine some holographic dual opening up. So the idea is that if we now allow the D3s to move on top of each other by going to higher energy scales, the Yang-Mills coupling is no longer set as G string divided by a number of fuzzy points, or rather G string itself. And when we do this, the radius of curvature becomes can now become parametrically larger. I don't know what that holographic dual looks like, but it sounds plausible that something like this is happening when we go to high enough energy.
I think that's set basically by a string, L string, something like that. So, I mean, it's a little bit murky because I think what's happening is you can imagine starting with an N equals 4 supernatant state going on to the Higgs branch of that theory, and you'll get something similar to this kind of picture. So it's like when we go into this branch here that we kind of kicks down off of N equals 4 to something much more complicated looking. But I don't know what, I think it's just the same thing. So we might also ask what happens if we now bring in an additional D3 brain along the similar lines. What happens to that brain? So, what did we do? We asked about what happens if you try and decouple gravity from one of these standard model type constructions. And what we were led to is a particular construction where the internal directions look fuzzy or non-commutable. Okay, so that's fine. And then what we also saw was that the inverse value of the gut coupling, or more precisely, inverse alpha gut, it's set as a discrete number, namely the number of fuzzy points. Okay, we also saw that that the description in terms of some kind of collective D3 brains, and this hints at some kind of looking at some kind of ensembles of these D3 brains and how they kind of form a more general structure. And we also saw that maybe there might be something interesting with the probes of the D3 brains. Okay, so that's.
Any questions? Okay, so let's thank the speaker again. Twelve for the next talk.